Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, Richard Ford tells us about his new novel, Canada.
You start to find yourself undoing things that you have done before. Well, for me, that's a sure sign that I've just about gotten it as good as I can get it.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Author Mark Hyman tells us about the rising cost of youth sports.
This may feel good for me. I may be getting something out of this experience, but it's not the best experience that my kid could have.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Richard Ford is one of America's great novelists, also one of the most admired and most deeply read by so many Americans, best known for his Frank Bascom trilogy, but there are many other important books as well, including a new novel called Canada. It's reviewed on our cover by Andre DeBus, who says, Canada is blessed with two essential strengths in equal measure, a mesmerizing story driven by authentic and fully realized characters, and a prose style so accomplished it is tempting to read each sentence two or three times before being pulled to the next. I'm delighted that Richard Ford is here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Thanks, Sam. Glad to get to talk to you.
Well, okay, we've gone back to Great Falls, Montana.
Yes. Well, I'm a comerbacker, which is to say, when I wrote about Great Falls, Montana in the 80s, and then some in the 90s, I thought, as I always think, that when I finished a book, I'm done with it, and I've taken all I can out of it. But what happens to me typically is that I start thinking about it again years later, and at the risk of repeating myself, which I think is a risk, but I think I avoid it generally, go back and see what else I can write, just because I begin to think that the previous books were not preliminary, not precursive in any way. I can stand on their shoulders and find something better.
Well, and in this case, we go back not only to a geographical area you've covered before, but back in time to 1960. Who's our narrator?
Our narrator is a 15-year-old boy named Dale Parsons who lives in Great Falls, Montana, and he has a twin sister, and he's the child with his sister of two mismatched parents, one Jewish girl from Tacoma, one Southern boy from Alabama, who are in their 30s. I call them boys because in some way they are kind of childlike. They run afoul of some Indians whom they owe money to, and in a panic decide that they have to rob a bank to get the money. And when they rob the bank, what they do is immediately get caught. And that causes the children's life to go haywire, really. The little girl runs away, runs to the West Coast. The little boy gets transported across the Canadian border into Saskatchewan, and thereafter ensues another story.
Something you're really great at, and reviewers comment on this all the time, is capturing that kind of the angst and also in this novel particularly, the shame and embarrassment of adolescence. How is that so vivid in your mind? You remember it from your own youth?
I remember feeling inadequate as an adolescent. My father died when I was 16 years old, and he died in my arms, and with my mother standing by in the state of hysteria. And I remember after this, and I don't think all fiction reduces itself to autobiography. You'd like to think you imagine some things, but I remember feeling that I couldn't cry when my father died. And I, to this day, don't know why. It's interesting you say embarrassment. I was very embarrassed about myself, that I didn't have what I thought were the standard emotions of grief.
And in this novel, we moved to Saskatchewan, which is another kind of forlorn, godforsaken place. And what happens to him there, to Dell?
In Saskatchewan, where he's taken across the border, he's put into the hands of strangers. And one of these strangers is an American who is himself on the run from the law, from having been involved in right-to-work violence in Detroit in 15 years prior to this. And he is, in this man's care, caused to be involved in a double murder, which he witnesses, although he doesn't participate in it. But then after this double murder occurs, he participates in burying the bodies out on the prairie.
Now, when you tell this novel, Richard, one of the striking things, again, is the precision of the detail. For instance, Dell's father at one point, you know, what he, as really dreamed of being as a pilot. I think he was in the Army Air Force as a
pilot. Yes, he was.
And all the details, the kind of planes, the kinds of engines are – they're set forth in an unshowy way. It's not an exhibition of your having command of all this detail, but you do have it. Where does that come from? Is that research? Do you remember it, a combination of both?
It comes from a little of both, actually. I mean, I wanted to put those B-25s in that sentence because the B-25s had a nickname which were called the Mitchells. They were named after Billy Mitchell. And I dug this up, but when I saw the word Mitchell, I just wanted to put it in a sentence. Most of the things that go into books of mine go in at least half because I like to see that word on the page and be able to hear it in my mind's ear, quite as much as the documentary value of it, the specificity of it. I just want the word. The reason that the book is half set in Saskatchewan is that every time I see Saskatchewan on the page, my heart skips a beat.
Do you hear the words when you write them? Do you say them aloud?
Absolutely.
You do.
I'm dyslexic, and so for me, words are quite as important in their non-cognitive qualities as they are important in their cognitive qualities. I would happily change the sense of a line if I could get a better word or another beat into the line. And that's just how rhymed and metered poetry works. Why shouldn't prose work the same way?
And yet your prose also has often a kind of spare quality to it. It's not the prose, it's not Joycean prose, it's very musical and a great deal of philosophy in the writing, contemplation of serious matters and issues and how we interpret the world around us. But there's also a precision and exactitude in the words themselves. Are you rewriting sentence after sentence? Are you one of those habitual improvers, self-improvers?
Yeah. I like to think that every time I set my hand to a sentence that I have parted with because I thought it was good, every time I set my hand to it again subsequently, I make it a little better. And that's finally, I guess, how I know that I'm finished with something, when I start to see myself, as writers do, who work at the pace that I work at, you start to find yourself undoing things that you have done before. You put a word back where the last time you saw it, you took it out. Well, for me, that's a sure sign that I've just about gotten it as good as I can get it.
So do you preserve every draft?
Well, yes, I do.
Yeah.
I don't do anything on – I mean, I type things on computers, but I write in longhand, and I edit in longhand, and I preserve everything. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe it's just a sort of pack rat impulse in me, but I keep it all.
Well, another great novelist your work has been compared to, John Updike, worked exactly the same way. He wrote in longhand, typed the drafts himself. Is there something to that physical process, that method of writing, that is being lost but is a very facile, easy use of the computer where you take the paragraph and block it and move it six pages later and everything comes out perfectly typed and you can over-refine? I mean, I've heard writers say this. Is this something you consciously don't do, or are you just writing out of the habit you've developed?
I'm just writing out of the habit that I developed because it was the way in which I could gain dominion over my sentences, because that for me is important. I mean, for me, being an author means that you authorize everything. And so, for me, on the computer, I would miss stuff. Things would, you know, you move a paragraph from place to place, which is so easy to do on a computer. I would lose my whole sense of where it is and where it was before and why it's where it is if I did it all electronically. I'm sure of that. And plus, probably from the early days when I started writing in the 60s, I like the work aspect. I like the artisanal aspect of putting words on the page. And I know John actually typed everything through a typewriter. I don't even know if at the end of his life he used a computer, but he certainly used a typewriter most of his life. I kind of like that. That seems okay to me. Plus, I mean, who cares if I'm in a hurry? Who cares if I'm slow? All anybody cares about if I write a book is that it be a good book. Doesn't have to come out sooner or later, just if it's good.
Richard, a number of reviewers, including ours, Andre DeBus, have commented on the hypnotic power of just the opening sentences of Canada. So I'll ask you to indulge me and read them.
I'll be glad to, Sam. Thank you. First, I'll tell about the robbery our parents committed, then about the murders, which happened later. The robbery is the most important part since it served to set my and my sister's lives on the courses they eventually followed.
Nothing would make complete sense without that being told first. Our parents were the least likely two people in the world to rob a bank. They weren't strange people, not obviously criminals. No one would have thought they were destined to end up the way they did, but they were just regular. Although, of course, that kind of thinking became null and void the moment they did rob a bank.
Thanks so much, Richard Ford.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Richard Ford, whose new novel, Canada, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So you have been making that long cross-town walk from the New York Times building to the Javits Center, where the annual Book Expo has been held this week. Tell us about it.
Well, it is truly the most beautiful part of New York City, the stroll past auto shops and abandoned lots and all the way to the Javits Center at the far reaches of the west side of Manhattan. And once you get there, you, of course, have to stroll the exhibit floor, check out all of the booths from the various publishers.
Right. The publishers pay a hefty fee to set up a booth with their pre-publication galleys and sometimes authors on hand signing books and such. It's really a trade convention, isn't it?
It is. It is the biggest trade convention of the year. It's a lot smaller than it used to be in the past, but this year there were close to 20,000 authors, publishers, librarians, booksellers, bloggers, a pretty diverse group of people throughout the industry who all gather for 3 days every year. This year there was an especially heavy emphasis on author signings. You kind of walked through the exhibit floor, and to me it felt a little bit like Disney World. You had people who were standing in line, and they would just plant themselves in line and say, okay, now I'm going to wait 1 hour for Ian McEwan to sign my book.
And he was there?
He was there.
Richard Ford was there because he came in and did the podcast with us.
Richard Ford was there. Justin Cronin was there. Tom Wolfe was there. Tons of authors.
Was Tom Wolfe there in one of his signature kind of Carnival Barker suits?
He certainly was. I mean, he wouldn't have been recognizable otherwise, but he did a few media appearances. He signed books. When I saw the Ian McEwan line, it stretched and snaked halfway through the convention floor, and there were some very devoted fans there.
Can I stop for 1 second here, Julie? We can make fun of Book Expo in this awful convention center, and it is true about New York. We're one of the great cities in the world. Some would say the greatest city in the world. We've got the Javits Center, which is, you know, not that great, and the worst airports in creation. How this happened, I don't know. But isn't it kind of nice to know you can go someplace where Ian McEwan, one of the great living novelists, is a kind of rock star?
It is really great. And I think, you know, people in New York, people who work in the publishing industry here tend to be a little bit jaded and cynical about BEA and complain about it and say that, you know, it's so annoying and difficult. But for people who live outside of New York, it's a huge thing for them because they are not around all of these New York publishing types all the time. They come in for a week, you know, they go to parties every single night.
And they pay to do this themselves, the booksellers, right? It's not open to the public.
They do. And you have, you know, a lot of really tiny bookstores in Pittsburgh and Oregon. And, you know, people come from all over the country because they want to know which books are going to be really big for the fall. And for publishers, you know, there's a huge opportunity here because they get to have a lot of in-person meetings with booksellers. A lot of publishers, you know, it's old-fashioned, but they do depend on independent booksellers to seize on a book, to really hand-sell it, and that can really make a huge difference. And as one publisher said to me yesterday, you know, as he stood in the Penguin booth, like, looking around and saying hi to people, he said, you know, word of mouth is still what really sells books.
Okay, Julie, my understanding is, because I normally spend a little time at a book expo each year, is there are some upcoming books that are creating a lot of buzz or excitement that there's a kind of wildfire quality. People are talking about a particular book or another. Did that happen at all this year? Were there any titles?
I don't know if there was a real breakout book, but I did hear a lot of people talking about Joe Nesbo, who was one of the speakers at the kickoff breakfast on Tuesday. And there were a few other books that certainly got a lot of buzz. The McEwen is one great example. That's a book that's coming out in November. Tom Wolfe is coming out with his first book in 8 years.
The first since I Am Charlotte Simmons?
That's right. And his new book is based in Miami.
Julie, also, the Book Expo sometimes has some genuine kind of media celebrities who are there to give talks or may have books coming out or give a keynote address. Anybody in particular of interest this year?
Well, I think the biggest celebrity this year, or at least the biggest rock star, was Neil Young. He has a book coming out this year by Blue Rider Press, which is an imprint of Penguin Group. That's the imprint run by David Rosenthal. There was a party in his honor on Wednesday. Neil Young was interviewed by Patti Smith, which was apparently an incredibly cool and charming event. When I showed up to the party for Neil Young on Tuesday night, it was a 2-hour party, and 90 minutes in, he was gone already. So he was showing how cool he was as a rock star by not staying to his own party.
90 minutes isn't bad, though.
It's a long time. And, you know, one of the publicists for the book said they were incredibly impressed that he stuck around for 90 minutes because he's not someone who really likes to hang out and talk to journalists for very long. So there was definitely, you know, that kind of celebrity element. And that's one thing that's especially great for people who are visiting from out of town.
No, I heard Stephen Colbert was there, too.
He was. He was the master of ceremonies at the breakfast on Tuesday morning. You know, he started things off by mentioning what is, of course, the biggest phenomenon of the publishing year so far, the 50 Shades of Grey trilogy. And he kind of peppered his speech with a lot of unrepeatable references to 50 Shades of Grey. And he also kind of made fun of the book industry in general in a sort of loving way by pointing out that Book Expo is the Lollapalooza of quietly reading to yourself. So kind of pointing out the slight absurdity of gathering to talk about books, which is, of course, a pretty solitary activity.
But in the end, it's kind of a cool thing, the Book Expo. And especially what you say for people who really love reading in books and live and work so far from this tiny little place, this part of Manhattan, Midtown, really, and, you know, a few streets below, where almost all of it happens, and here's their chance to interact. So thanks.
Thanks, Sam.
All across America, parents are investing more and more money in their kids' sports activities. There's a new book. It's called The Most Expensive Game in Town: The Rising Cost of Youth Sports and the Toll on Today's Families. It's by Mark Hyman, and it's reviewed for us by Gordon Marino, who says that Hyman's work should give anyone who feels the psychic tug of tryouts and travel teams even more pause about joining the ranks of helicopter sports parents. Not long ago, Mark Hyman visited the Times, and we chatted briefly about the rising costs and the remarkable phenomenon of kids and sports in America. Mark, why do youth sports cost so much? What's the price they're exacting from children and their families today?
Well, Sam, I don't know if you've bought an aluminum baseball bat for your 6-year-old recently, but if you have, I think you know why youth sports cost so much, because you can spend $300 for a bat for a T-ball player, and that's kind of insane. And it's really the tip of the iceberg in terms of the stuff, the junk that we've surrounded youth sports with.
Okay, now we're living in very tough economic times. Parents want their children to get ahead. Do some of them actually think sports is the gateway to success or careers?
Yeah, I think this is a big part of the psychology that underlies what I'm talking about in this book. To some parents, sports is a career path, and it's a competitive kind of situation where, you know, if you see your neighbor's kid playing in an organized league at age three, that's a concern for you. You want your kid to be in that league at age three. You don't want your child to fall behind. And I think that fuels a lot of the commercialism that I'm talking about in the book.
Now, what about the toll on children themselves? All right, we know the parent is paying $300 for the aluminum bat. What about the child who's not going to swing it as well as the kid down the street or be the all-star on the Little League team?
Yeah, I think this is damaging in a couple of ways. And in a sense, it's an equal opportunity damaging kind of effect on the kids who are more affluent and the kids who are coming from the less privileged backgrounds. For the less privileged kids, it's really a question of access. You have kids who literally can't afford to participate in the sport because they're not getting, you know, the coaching that the more affluent kids are getting. They're not getting the opportunities to have the, you know, to play on the travel teams, to travel to tournaments, the access to the things that cost. So that's one set of issues. Now, for the kids who are more affluent, I think the problem is that parents are buying into this idea that if they start their kids young enough and invest enough emotionally and financially in their sports lives, that they can really turn them into the next Tiger Woods. And it's, I think it's dangerous for kids. I mean, 50% of all youth sports injuries are the result of overuse. Kids just doing the same thing over and over and over again until their bodies really, you know, give out. So there are lots of reasons to take it slow and not to buy into this kind of culture of consumerism.
Mark, we're not just talking about boys, but girls as well.
No, absolutely not. Title IX, which, you know, is familiar to most of us, the, you know, federal legislation that has resulted in great strides for women in terms of participation, not only at the high school level, but the college level, has been a great advantage for women. Again, women are so much more participants in youth sports than they ever have been. But there are negative consequences, too. Now, just like the boys, women are overdoing it at the high school level, at the rec fields, and the injuries that we previously only saw with boys, now we're seeing an equal number with girls.
You mentioned baseball bats. There must be a lot of companies, a lot of products that are making a great deal of money because of this fascination, obsession with youth sports.
Absolutely. And, you know, one wonderful example, I think, is the kind of cottage industry that's grown up around training babies and toddlers to be athletes. And this sounds fantastic, I realize, but it really is true. There are a number of companies that have put out DVDs to train and introduce babies to sports, and also a number of national chains that have developed youth sports programs. There's one soccer, youth sports national soccer program for kids starting at 18 months. And you know, this is an example of how private enterprises kind of leveraged this feeling that we have that we've got to get our kids started as early as we possibly can. And, you know, it's interesting because I've interviewed numerous pediatric sports medicine experts and pediatricians about this idea of, you know, when should your child really start in organized sports? When can a child benefit from being involved in an organized fashion in sports? And almost universally, the answer is age 7 or 8. Before that, maybe it's a socialization experience for your child, but you're not training your child to be anything before 7 or 8. Yet, you know, a number of companies have found that they can kind of leverage a parent's insecurities about when their child should be involved in sports to, you know, to develop a business.
Mark, you know, one idea that we've had for many years in this country is sports, particularly a generation or two, say, boxing or basketball, was a way out for poorer children who might not have access to all the opportunities in the culture. Now we seem to be talking about affluent, suburban, exurban families who are choosing that course for their children. Why has this happened?
I don't think there's one answer to that question. I would say there's several factors. One is that for many families, the notion that a child can be put on a track to get a college scholarship and get actual, you know, for there to be some financial reward at the end of this rainbow, I think that's very real. And you do meet, you know, I've interviewed many families in which, you know, the idea is that a child, you know, starting in golf or tennis or whatever sport can be trained and given enough support so that they can get a college scholarship. But it goes far beyond that, I think. I think for many families, there's a certain prestige and stature attached to having a child who is a standout athlete. I mean, kids are performing in a very public way in front of other parents, and it's a kind of validation of a parent's, the job that a parent has done in raising a child who excels as an athlete. I've written about that in my own case, where, you know, I had a son who was a very good Little League baseball pitcher, and when he was out on the mound, I was like a good 6 inches taller, because he was striking out those other 12-year-old kids. So I think this is kind of almost a universal experience. You know, this is in our DNA, that when our children succeed in sports, yes, there may be some financial benefit down the road for us as a family, but there's also this feeling that it's validation of ourselves as parents.
Not long ago, Americans were introduced to the idea of these very brilliantly gifted, very young gymnasts in the Olympics. And we got that idea that these were families who'd raised their kids in this particular way. And then maybe tennis stars too, very young tennis stars. Is it now spilling out into all sports, including violent ones, hockey, football?
Oh, absolutely. And again, I think this is a function in part of the whole college scholarship dream. It's interesting because the amount of money available for college athletic scholarships is quite small. And in fact, 5% of high school varsity athletes will end up playing at the college level. 5%, that's a small number.
At any college level, including Division III?
Any college level. In terms of scholarship dollars, 1% of high school varsity athletes will ever earn a dollar of college money in that way. So the odds are really long. I mean, you might get hit by a meteor before your child is playing for a college team and getting any scholarship dollars. But that's not well understood by parents. I think in part because of the commercialization that we're talking about, there are lots of companies that benefit financially by preserving this idea that you can do it. You know, if your kid is taking the lessons, if your kid's going to the travel tournaments, this is a possibility for your child.
Okay, Mark, we've talked about parents. Let's talk about the kids. If you're growing up in a suburban neighborhood and you're, you know, pretty good ball player, there may be a lot of other better ball players around. Do you find yourself as a small child in a cycle of competing over your head? Are there psychological consequences?
I can cite two very powerful statistics about this. Here's the first. By age 11, a majority of kids have dropped out of youth sports. That's the peak, age 11. Kids are losing interest after that. And why? Because for the most part, our youth sports kind of culture caters to the most talented kids. We're not really all that interested in recreation and participation. We want to advance, as a culture, we want to advance the interests of those most talented kids. And that's a shame, because sports should be a lifetime activity. It should be part of our DNA, part of what we do as people throughout our lives. But the way youth sports are set up, it really doesn't work that way. It's very much a culture driven by the needs and ambitions of the most talented kids.
Mark, you mentioned one a vital statistic. What's another?
To me, it's astonishing that 50% of all the youth sports injuries, reported injuries to youth sports athletes, are the result of simple overuse. Kids playing sports year-round, too intensely, to their own detriment.
And do you think there'll be any reaction to this? Is there any evidence that some children and parents, or maybe educators, are beginning to rethink this obsession with youth sports?
Well, you know, I interviewed lots of parents for this book, as you can imagine, a book about youth sports and families' attitudes about them. And I feel like, you know, based on my reporting, there is a dissatisfaction with the status quo. I think many parents realize this is not right. This may feel good for me. I may be getting something out of this experience, but it's not the best experience that my kid could have. And, you know, where that tipping point is, I really don't know. But I do think that there's a growing awareness that the status quo is really not in the interest of kids.
That was Mark Hyman, whose new book, The Most Expensive Game in Town, is reviewed in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Sam.
So, Greg, Clive Cussler, familiar name, back in a familiar spot.
Yeah, he is at the top of the hardcover fiction list. He makes his debut at number one this week with a new Numa Files novel called The Storm. Then another familiar name, Jeff Shara, who writes military histories, is at number seven with the first of a trilogy about this the westernmost battles in the Civil War. This is a book called A Blaze of Glory, and it recreates the Battle of Shiloh. Then at number 13, Joseph Cannon, another historical thriller writer.
Who writes for us sometimes.
Yeah, he does. You know, smart thriller writer. He's got a book called Istanbul Passage that hits the list at number 13. Most of his books are set just after World War II, kind of looking at shifting geopolitics, kind of espionage stuff. This one's set in Istanbul. And then sneaking onto the list at number 16, the New Zealand paranormal romance writer Nalini Singh has a novel called Tangle of Need. I don't understand these books at all. It's the Psy Changeling series, and there's a wolf changeling in this and various paranormal things.
About 40 years ago, I think it was, Edmund Wilson wrote an essay, Edmund Wilson, the great critic, and he said, "When I look through the pages of Life magazine, I am looking at a country I do not recognize." And I have to say, sometimes with some of these novels, I'm sure they're terrific.
In all fairness, she's from New Zealand.
And all the more so. We've gone global. We're looking at a planet that I don't understand. What about nonfiction?
Just two new nonfiction books this week. At number seven, Eric Blem has a book called Fearless, about the Navy SEAL Team 6 member Adam Brown, who was killed in Afghanistan. The Navy SEALs have been big on the nonfiction list lately. There's another nonfiction book down at number 12 by Marcus Luttrell. It's called Service. He was a member of the Navy SEALs also. He was rescued in a big rescue mission over in Afghanistan, and he's now written a memoir. American Sniper, the Chris Kyle book about being a sniper for the Navy SEALs, is still hanging on to the extended list. So yeah, Navy SEALs are like the Green Berets of today. The public can't read enough about them. Then at number six, Douglas Brinkley's new biography of Walter Cronkite is new on the list.
And that's kind of a big deal, and we have it out with a quite prominent reviewer. We haven't seen the review yet. Do we know at this stage whether there are surprises or revelations in this book?
Not revelations that I know of. I think that a lot of it has been reported before, but he really pulls everything together to give a complete picture. Brinkley's a serious historian. He's a professor at Rice University in Houston. Cronkite, of course, grew up in Houston, and a lot of what Brinkley does is kind of Texas-centric or Gulf Coast-centric. He wrote a book on Hurricane Katrina. He also looked at John Kerry's military service. He's been on our list several times in the past. He's edited some Reagan books.
Diaries.
Yeah, right. the diaries and also a book called The Notes that was notes that Reagan took throughout his career. So this book, it pulls the curtain back on Cronkite. It reminds those of us who didn't know that Cronkite liked to frequent strip clubs. It goes a little bit into the tensions between Cronkite and Dan Rather after Rather took over the anchor chair at CBS. He was Cronkite's handpicked successor, but then Cronkite felt kind of sidelined and minimized, and he resented that somewhat. It's not a hagiography by any means. It's quite a serious book. It has an interesting story in it about the novelist Tim O'Brien, the author of The Things They Carried and Going After Cacciato. He's also a Vietnam veteran and writes a lot about Vietnam. And Cronkite, of course, in 1968, after the Tet Offensive, made a very famous statement against the war. Before that, he had not taken a position or had been maybe pro-war. And after the Tet Offensive, he said, "This is it. It's a stalemate. You know, we're not going to win this thing." Tim O'Brien has previously credited Cronkite with getting him into fiction writing. He grew up in Minnesota. He watched Cronkite's early CBS program, You Are There, growing up, and he said each week they were these kind of mini short stories based in fact, and that it really taught him a lot about narrative, and that he might not have become a novelist without that show. He was giving a speech, Tim O'Brien was, at Horace Mann School in New York sometime in the mid-90s after his novel In the Lake of the Woods came out. And he looks down and there's Cronkite sitting in the front row. Cronkite came up to him after and said, "I'm deaf as a stone. I couldn't hear a word you said. Can I take you to dinner?" And O'Brien was flattered, and they went out to dinner at a diner up on the Upper West Side. Cronkite was really concerned about Tim O'Brien's perspective as a Vietnam veteran. He said, "What did I do to morale back in 1968 when I came out against the war? Was it a bad thing that I did?" And O'Brien reassured him, you know, from his own perspective that no, you know, he agreed with him and was glad to have heard him say it.
And since Cronkite was deaf, he didn't understand a word he heard. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.